And we're in the book of Nehemiah, on the screen, chapter 2, we're at verses 1 to 10, that's page 485 for those who want the fast reference. And for those of you who missed last week, it should be obvious that we've got started on a new series in the book of Nehemiah, the Old Testament, set about 445 years before Jesus came to earth. And last week, we were left on this cliffhanger, having discovered that the city of Jerusalem was still in ruins, and it seemed that God laid on Nehemiah's heart a longing for this to be changed. In fact, Nehemiah effectively said to God, "Here I am, send me to help restore your people and your city." And so in doing so, he offered to give up the comfort of his prominent position as the cupbearer, you remember this? The cupbearer to King Arti of the Persian Empire. And to exchange that, as we're going to find out, for some dangerous work in Jerusalem. And so that brings us hopefully up to date with roughly where we are at the start of chapter 2. We're reading verses 1 to 10. When the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before, so the king asked me, "Why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart." I was very much afraid, but I said to the king, "May the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" The king said to me, "What is it you want?" Then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king, "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my fathers are buried so that I can rebuild it." Then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked me, "How long will your journey take, and when will you get back?" It pleased the king to send me, so I set a time. I also said to him, "If it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governors of Trans-Euphrates, so that they will provide me safe conduct until I arrive in Judah. And may I have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the king's forest, so he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple, and for the city wall, and for the residence I will occupy. And because the gracious hand of my God was upon me, the king granted my requests." So I went to the governors of Trans-Euphrates and gave them the king's letters. The king had also sent army officers and cavalry with me. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about this, they were very much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. Lord God, as we have just heard your words, and as I've looked at it over the last week or so, Lord, would you take my words right now? Would you prepare our hearts? And would you help us to hear what you have to say to us this day? Amen. Well, I wonder how you feel about waiting. Do you enjoy a nice long wait? Anyone enjoy a nice long wait? No. You see, I'm with you. I'm culturally British, though, and therefore, I almost certainly, other than at this moment in time, you won't find me moaning about the fact I have to queue. You know, not least out loud. But in America, they're a bit different, aren't they? And they aren't happy with this. In fact, they've done research into queuing and waiting because they want to solve this problem. And so there's a short video from the Washington Post which offers us some interesting insights which I want to share with you on the psychology of waiting. Have a watch. The first becomes last and the last becomes first. That's not my sermon, but you know, I'll save that for another time. I wonder how much of that you can relate to. this idea that the core issues behind waiting are a combination of boredom, uncertainty, and anxiety. Now, of course, the influence of those elements alters depending on why you're waiting. If you're waiting for the results of tests compared to waiting for a coffee, then your response is going to be very different. However, if we introduce the time pressure into grabbing a coffee, then actually that scenario can start to become quite stressful, can't it? Even though it's not actually important in the scheme of things. And similarly, a delay at the GP's where gets thrown into sharp relief when we suddenly find an ambulance turns up and people come rushing in, and suddenly we realise actually our situation can wait in comparison to somebody else's. And of course, these are casual examples, if you like. There are more and more serious examples and difficult ones about waiting. There's the waiting of a single person to see if God has marriage in store for them. There's the waiting of a childless couple desperately wanting to start a family, but month after month having disappointment and heartache. There's the waiting of someone who longs to have work that's meaningful, significant, and seems to matter, and yet that just doesn't seem to happen. And there's even the waiting of a spouse that's trapped in a hurting marriage that seems unable to change. Lewis Meads describes waiting like this. Waiting is our destiny. As creatures who cannot by themselves bring about what they hope for, we wait in the darkness for a flame we cannot light. We wait in fear for a happy ending that we cannot write. We wait for a not yet that feels like a not ever. Nehemiah is also waiting. It's now been 4 months since he first felt the burden God placed upon him to pray for the people and the city of Jerusalem. But what's changed? Nothing. I mean, he's still in the same job. He's still going about the same routine. He's most likely still offering the same prayers to God on behalf of his people. Well, actually, I'm not sure that is true. You see, I would suggest that something has changed. Probably his level of frustration. I mean, if he's anything like the rest of us, 4 months of seemingly unanswered prayer is a long time, right? Yet why persist? Well, I think this is the key to understanding everything we find in our passage today. Because Nehemiah believes that his God is sovereign and in control. In verse 8, Nehemiah declares this after everything that has happened. Because of the gracious hand of my God was upon me. Because the gracious hand of my God was upon me, the king granted my requests. Now, anyone who has been successful at some point in their life will know that it's easy to take credit for it. I mean, if we win an award or someone offers us a compliment, it's easy how it can suddenly just pop up in a conversation. You know the kind of thing. Oh yeah, I've had a quiet week. I mean, once I got back from collecting my award from the National Forum of Amazing Preachers, I've just, what are you laughing at? I said, yeah, fake news. Okay, yeah, fair enough. You get the idea, right? You must know people who do that. But for Nehemiah, in his moment of success, we find he points the finger towards God and declares it's because of him. His grace, his hand of action, his mercy to me and my situation. That is how I have a way to carry out the task that he has laid before me. And so as we work through this passage and pull out a few points, I want us to start from a place that recognizes that God is in control. That he is in charge of the task he's laid on Nehemiah's heart. For if this isn't the case, then basically the whole passage doesn't make any sense. So let's rewind and let's see what the text teaches us about God and how Nehemiah reacts in light of his sovereignty. And firstly, I think we note, we learn to be patient. Why? Because God's timing is perfect. You see, when we left Nehemiah last week, it was the months of Kislev. You remember, mid-November to mid-December. And in today's reading, we're in the month of Nisan, not some product placement in the Bible. No, this is between mid-March and mid-April. And it's also the start of the Jewish sacred year, as decreed by God after Moses led his people out of Egypt. And so just like any New Year celebrations we have, this brings with it the sense of renewed hope. A new year has come, a new start, new possibilities. Yet for Nehemiah, after 4 months of prayer, fasting, and longing, it seems that his church mask, if you will, has fallen away and he's no longer able to hide his sadness. You see, I think waiting is the hardest work of hope. And yet when we turn to the Bible, God himself, God who is all-powerful, all-wise, all-loving, assures us over and over again that he wants us to wait. Take Psalm 37, verse 7. Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Wait for the Lord, the psalmist goes on. Keep to his ways, and he will exalt you to inherit the land. And time again, the Bible offers us examples of people who are told to wait before the Lord. Take Joseph. He had to wait 13 years. Abraham, 25 years. Moses, 40 years. Even Jesus had to wait 30 years. If God makes you wait, actually, you're in good company. But then the obvious question is, why? I mean, why does God make us wait? If he can do anything, as we sang earlier, and if he's all loving, and why doesn't he just bring us relief and answers now? Well, I'm going to be straight with you. I certainly don't be able to claim to fully answer or even understand all the elements of that question. But I do think, in having spent some time with this, that Ben Patterson offers us a good summary of what we do see as we work through the Bible. He says this: what God does in us while we wait is as important as what we're waiting for. What God does in us while we wait is as important as what we're waiting for. You see, friends, he's refining us. He's making us uncomfortable, but also dependent. He's revealing his strength in our weakness. And it's a truth that is hard to grasp in the middle of waiting. I completely agree with that. But it's a truth I think our hearts constantly need to hear. See, Paul says, the Apostle Paul, while we're waiting for God to set everything right, we suffer. He's a happy man, isn't he? But suffering produces perseverance. And perseverance produces character. And character produces hope. God is producing these qualities in us while we wait. So waiting isn't just something we have to do until we get what we want. Actually, waiting is part of a process of becoming what God wants us to be. He is shaping us, discipling us, growing us, no matter how painful that may be. And in the case of Nehemiah, he knows God has a task for him to do. And he will have been looking forward to the moment when God would open up that opportunity for him to speak to the king. But in the meantime, Nehemiah must be patient, waiting for God's perfect timing. Now, historians tell us that Eastern monarchs were sensitive fellows, needing to be protected from anything that made them sad. And so this may explain why in verse 2, Nehemiah is said to be afraid when the king comments on his change in demeanor. Most people can put on a happy face, can't we, when we have to. You'd agree with that? We can basically force it out, can't we? Yeah. But when there's something that is deeply troubling you, like an issue which is affects the very being of you almost, my experience is that those who know you well can nearly always see through that mask. Now, I'm not saying that Nehemiah and the king were best buddies, but he will have been in the king's presence every day, all day. And so it makes sense that the king would pick up on Nehemiah's heart problem for Jerusalem. And here, Nehemiah faces a turning point. You see, because he has a choice of which set of spectacles he could put on. Either that this has been noticed, and therefore he is dead or going to prison, or he puts on the other spectacles, which says, this is an opportunity that I've been waiting for. This is my point when I can finally speak about the thing that has been troubling me because the king has asked me. You see, Nehemiah is called to be brave as God creates an opportunity for him to speak. And I wonder how often you've faced a moment like this, when you could have offered to pray for someone or spoken up for a colleague or even challenged a situation you've seen occurring. I mean, there's real discernment needed about how you go forwards in those situations, but there is also immense bravery needed too. And for Nehemiah, this is no random situation. Remember, this needs to be seen in the context of 4 months of prayer, fasting, longing for a solution to the situation of God's justice, which he's burdened him with. And so this would strike me as that uncomfortable moment, maybe some of you can relate to this, when you get that prompting from the Holy Spirit, which forces you to know that you're the person who needs to speak, or to respond into the dead silence of a room, basically to be brave as God's servant. Now, many of you would have known I was at a conference at the start of the week, and I wanted to share a testimony I heard there. This is someone else's testimony, but I think it will be helpful. Sally. This is not her real name, but Sally is a pastor with a young family. And she told us about how she had moved to a new area and then had got into that pattern of dropping off her kids and going to the local coffee shop with a group of mums and having lighthearted conversation. And about 9 months in, there was one day when there was only her and another mum who actually went to this coffee shop. And Sally did the thing that we all do. We say, how's your week been? And at that moment, Sally said she knew that their relationship took on a whole nother depth. Because the lady stopped pretending, and she poured out her troubles. She said, I'm not well. My family are really struggling. I'm not sleeping well. I have immense pain in my back, and I just can't take any of this anymore. Well, Sally did what all of us would probably do. You know, have you seen the doctor? Are you having medication? How's it? Yes, yes, I've done all that, her friend said. I've done everything I can to try and solve this, but I'm out of options. Well, Sally, the pastor, consoled her, and they eventually headed their separate ways. And as Sally left, she described the feeling of being sick rising within her. A real unrest came over her. And as she puts it, she thought, what an idiot. Here I am, a pastor, and I didn't even offer to pray for her. Well, as the day went on and turned to night, this unrest and sick feeling continued. She couldn't sleep. And so at some unearthly hour, she got up and decided to go for a run and use that time to pray. And as she ran, she said to God something like this. Lord, I'm sorry for having failed you to take the chance to pray for this lady. Please forgive me for letting you down. But Lord, if a chance should come again, I promise I will offer to pray and will trust you in that situation. Well, for about another 20 minutes, she continued her run and praying, and she talks about how she was rounding her last corner when who do you guess she saw walking towards her? That's right, the lady from the coffee house who also can't sleep. Seriously, God? Seriously? And as they met in the street, they both exchanged stories of that restless night and inability to sleep. And Sally took this as her cue to offer to pray for the lady. And the lady accepted with tears of gratitude, and some weeks later reported having had a sense that night of a peace which was unlike anything she had experienced before. Nothing changed. Her situation remained the same, but she felt a peace like nothing before. And in fact, that moment was so powerful because of that obedience and that God situation that 6 months later, that lady did indeed give her life to Christ. Now, I feel privileged being able to share someone else's testimony, but I want to share it because also it shows that it's shared out of vulnerability. You know, out of her failure and a repentant willingness to try again. To be willing to step up and respond more faithfully the next time. You see, like Nehemiah, it called for her to recognize the opportunity God had created and then to be brave and step into that gap. And now if we remember that God has been preparing Nehemiah for this moment, we also see that Nehemiah has used the time to form a plan. You see, he hasn't sat around for 4 months meditating and mourning. Rather, he has combined that with thinking about the situation in front of him. I mean, if he does get to speak to the king, I mean, if God really does what he says he's going to do, what will he say? What will he need? How long will he be gone? What is the best way to win the king's favor? You see, in the text, he's done his research and in the spirit of prayer has come up with a plan to present before the king. And friends, it's a bold plan. But it's also a clever plan that speaks to the king's tradition of respecting their ancestors, as well as listing his actual needs without ever mentioning, if you notice, Jerusalem. You see, when God calls us to wait, that doesn't mean we just sit on our hands and do nothing. Saying, I'm waiting on the Lord, is not an excuse to face up to the reality which you're in, taking appropriate action, or owning up to our own responsibility. Waiting on the Lord does not just mean hoping a letter comes through the mail, for instance, to resolve an outstanding debt. Of course, we do pray for miracles. Of course, we spend time in worship and silence and meditating on God. Of course we do. The Bible teaches us that. Don't mishear me. But we also trust God is working as we seek out good advice, as we study the biblical principles about a life of good stewardship, about how we knock on doors and we pray that he would open the ones which will help our situation. Because biblical waiting is not passive. I would say waiting on the Lord is really a confident, disciplined, expectant, active, sometimes painful clinging to God. Waiting on the Lord is the continual daily decision to say something like this: God, I will trust you and I will obey you even though circumstances of my life are not turning out the way I want them to, and they may never turn out the way I want them to. But I'm betting everything on you, God. I have no plan B. You see, if God is truly sovereign of all things in our lives, if we are truly submitting ourselves before him, then we need to be trusting him. to believe that he knows what he is doing and will make a way for us in our darkest valley experiences, as well as when we have those mountaintop highs. Nehemiah had no idea how God was going to get him from Susa to Jerusalem. He had no idea how he was going to be released from the king's service, how he could travel safely or even face the real present dangers listed in verse 10. He had no idea how, but he knew who would deliver him. His sovereign God, as he declares in verse 8. Not because of his genius plan or preparations, but because of God's gracious hand. In fact, we even find God spoils him with a military attaché to boot. You see, friends, let's be honest, life can be rubbish at times, can't it? I mean, it can throw us all kinds of curveballs, and when that happens, questions of how firm our foundations as Christians are always come into sharp relief. Yet in Matthew 7, Jesus likens the person who trusts in his words and puts them into practice to that of a man who built his house upon a rock. When the storms came lashing, the house remained firm and stood the test of time. But for those who ignore or doubted his words, when the storms come, their foundation is found wanting and they get washed away. And yet, friends, Jesus doesn't want anyone to be washed away by the storms that come. That's true. He doesn't want you to get washed away by the storms that come. He longs for you all to know and trust in the sovereignty of our Creator God, who removes the anxiety and uncertainty of life, because in our hearts we know that what Christ has done, not just in our heads, but in our hearts we know that what Christ has done offers us hope for something beyond this world, beyond the situation you're in, whether that's good or bad. Now, Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. That he came to earth as man, but also fully God, and offers us eternal hope through his life, death, and resurrection. That is the cornerstone upon which our hope is built. And yet, if your foundations have been shaken by times when we think God has failed us, friends, we need to wrestle with those moments. We need to face up to those times, not ignore them, not hide them away, but work through them with God and perhaps with other wise Christians around you. See, to deny or ignore them can lead us to a place of uncertainty. And then that's the fastest way, friends, isn't it, to lose your footing in any situation if you're unsure. But if we're going to be bold for Christ, if we want to stand firm, then whilst knowing Jesus personally is vital, I'd also suggest you need to understand and believe the truth that God also knows you. As his word tells us that we are graven, written on his hands. Theologian James Packer puts it in this way, and I think that some of you today need to hear these words. I can know Jesus because he first knew me and continues to know me. He knows me as a friend, one who loves me. And there is no moment when his eye is off me or his attention distracted from me, and no moment, therefore, when his care falters. Friends, the times of waiting are also times of growth. And as we wait prayerfully for God's perfect timing and trust in his hand upon the opportunities he knows we need, might we bow before him. And if he calls you to a task, or he places you in an opportunity before you. Friends, be brave. Step out, because you can know that he is the one who has made that opening. That it's he who feels that you are the right person at the right moment for that task. Because he wouldn't ask you unless he knew that you could do it. I mean, he might not ask you to carry out a task like Nehemiah's. I mean, that's ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, it's crazy. Yeah? But the task that he offers you may still feel as big as the task he asked Nehemiah to do. Does that make sense? Yeah, in our world, it can feel that way. And yet, know that the one who calls you will make a way, no matter how deep or dark the valley in front of you seems, if you trust in him and remain in his will. Now, last week I challenged you to see if there was one thing you thought you could learn more about, an issue that deeply mattered to you, or to pray to God to open up your eyes to something that mattered to him that he could use you in. And this week I want to offer a similar challenge to you, to ask you to be open to taking a risk. And I know at that moment, many of you just tried to hide as far down in your chairs as you could. That's fine. Because, friends, I'm not going to check on you. And that's not what my role is as pastor, as far as I'm aware. But that's between you and God. But God knows how you feel. And it's a loving God who wants you to grow in your faith in him, not dismantle it. And so this week I invite you to ask God to open a new opportunity for you to serve him. Offer yourself as a willing servant to be guided by him, asking him to prompt you in what you should do. I mean, maybe it'll be helping a stranger or speaking more boldly to a friend who phones you or someone you see in person. Maybe it's something he wants to resolve in you, maybe an old conflict he wants you to deal with, or something he's prompting you to confess that you've really been trying to hide for a long, long time. Perhaps it's to offer comfort to a colleague where you would have run a mile, or perhaps to talk to someone about Jesus or even why church is so important to you, just for that 30 seconds that they give you. See, I don't know what he's got in store for you if you're willing to say yes. And he may even, when you say yes, make you wait, growing your willingness and seeing your desire to serve. Ultimately, he knows best. But friends, if waiting is the thing for you, let me say this. Don't give up offering yourself daily to him because he's asking you to wait. It'll be very easy to go, oh, Kevin said do this, so I'm trying it and nothing's happening. You know, part of obedience is being willing to say yes, yes, yes every day, Lord, I want to serve you. I've got no plan B. You're my way. And so whatever or wherever it is, know and trust that he loves you and wants to use you for his kingdom glory. See, faith grows when we step out and trust him in boldness, but that will only happen if we're willing to offer ourselves. Be patient. Be expectant. Keep your eyes and hearts open to the prompting of the Spirit. Continue to talk with him in prayer as you carry out your daily activities, and have confidence to respond when he calls, trusting in his gracious, loving hand to guide you. The disciples were sent out by Jesus, weren't they, into an unknown place to share the gospel, a dangerous place, guided by his Spirit. The prophets were guided to grieve for God's longing for justice and mercy. And today, he still guides us into unknown waters for his glory. But are you willing to be patient before our sovereign God, being brave when he calls and trusting in him to watch over you as he promises, not just being someone who says that's what you do?